Good afternoon. I'm Susan Margulies, the Assistant Director for Engineering at the United States National Science Foundation, and I'm very pleased to welcome you today to this very special symposium, Smart Health Frontiers: Driving Innovation with Fundamental Science, Precision Medicine Through Engineering. We're hosting the symposium to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the Smart Health Program. We have three distinguished speakers for you today, all of whom are working at the cutting edge of biomedical technology and engineering. But before we get to their talks, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about the Smart Health Program, which funded their work. Smart Health is a multidisciplinary collaboration between NSF and the National Institutes for Health. The Smart Health Program is designed to accelerate innovative research that bridges that gap between technological and biomedical research to help transform biomedical and public health research into the United States. A key component of this process and the program is to create sustainable partnerships between engineers, scientists, and medical practitioners to ensure that the most innovative and transformative technical research target the most critical biomedical engineering questions. The goal is to ensure that practitioners and the patients are able to take full advantage of the advances in engineering and computing because they've been part of the research from the start. Engineering, artificial intelligence, and other technological advances are poised to expand and accelerate positive contributions to multiple sectors of American society, to integrate into health-related fields and applications. And there's a unique challenge in doing that, as you all have appreciated firsthand. Today's symposium will showcase how advances in engineering can help create targeted and tailored solutions to critical medical issues that are facing the American public, including chronic conditions like diabetes, HIV, and infertility. Increasingly, novel scientific approaches and new technologies are providing healthcare providers with better tools for disease detection and better data for disease progression and management, which in turn guides more effective diagnostic and intervention protocols. Together, engineering, science, and the medical community can create a healthier tomorrow for us all. So what I'd like to do now is to introduce us, our speakers, and then they will each speak in turn. So I'm going to introduce all three of them at the start. Our first speaker is Yannis Pashalidis. Dr. Pashalidis is a distinguished professor of electrical and computer engineering, systems engineering, and biomedical engineering, and a founding professor of computing and data sciences at Boston University. He is the director of the Harari Institute for Computing and Computational Science and Engineering, Boston University's Federation and Convergence Accelerator of centers and initiatives in this area of research. He has a PhD from MIT in electrical engineering and computer science, and his current research interests lie in the field of optimization, control, stochastic systems, robust learning, computational medicine, and computational biology. His work has been recognized at the very start with a career award from NSF, and he's won numerous awards for his research since that time. Our second speaker is Dr. Chaitra Gopalappa. Dr. Gopalappa is an associate professor of industrial engineering at the Department of Mechanical and Industrial Engineering and Commonwealth Honors College at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's a guest researcher at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She has a PhD in industrial engineering from the University of South Florida, Tampa, and her work is in the area of simulation, simulation-based optimization, and reinforcement learning, stochastic processes, all applied to the areas of health and social equity research. Her lab is funded with grants from the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, the U.S. CDC, and the World Health Organization. And our final speaker today is Ramesh Johari. Dr. Johari is a professor at Stanford University with a full-time appointment in the Department of Management Science and Engineering and a courtesy appointment in the Department of Electrical Engineering. He is an associate director of the Stanford Data Science Center and also on the executive committee of the Stanford Causal Science Center. He's a member of Operations Research Group and the Social Algorithms Lab, the Informational Systems Laboratory, and the Institute for Computational and Mathematical Engineering. He received his PhD in electrical engineering and computer science from MIT, and his recent research includes data-driven decision-making, causal inference, and experimental design, particularly as applied to online platforms and digital health interventions. So please join me today in this webinar. And our first speaker is Dr. Pashalidis.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this exciting symposium. Let me share my slides. And let me ask for a confirmation if you can see the slide in slide mode. Perfect. Thank you. So today I'm going to talk about predictive models of pregnancy and health conditions associated with infertility. And this is work that has been funded by the Smart Health program at NSF. And let me start by some basic facts that I think provide some evidence that there are accelerating challenges for family planning. First, the average age of first mothers in the US has been increasing steadily from about 21 or so years in 1970. 2021 was 27.3 years. And clearly the probability of conceiving naturally is dropping quite drastically with age. So currently in the US, about 15% of couples are suffering from infertility and subfertility. About 12% of women, about 9.4% of men use infertility services. There are technologies out there that come under the name assisted reproductive technologies, ART for short. IVF, in vitro fertilization, is one version of those technologies. And these technologies can help couples in order to conceive. For instance, an IVF cycle has a probability of success, generic, about 1 out of 3 IVF cycles. And there is a pretty significant cost associated with these types of services. So the cost of an IVF cycle is anywhere between $15,000 to $30,000. And because this is not universally covered by insurance, this creates obvious disparities. There are certain conditions, for instance, polycystic ovary syndrome, that affects about 15% of women. And this is the leading cause of ovulatory infertility. And it's also causing long-term health issues at a cost that has been estimated to be on the order of $4.4 billion annually in the US. So with these facts in mind, the question that we set out to answer is, what can we, the NSF Smart Health community, do to help? And I would like to thank NSF, and particularly Wendy Nielsen, that had the vision to start this program, and understanding that there's quite significant things that people that are closer to the sciences, mathematical sciences, computer sciences, can have an impact in smart health type of applications. So in terms of what I think we can do is we can leverage streams of data and unleash the power of AI, machine learning algorithms in order to develop predictive analytics. And in this particular presentation, I'm going to discuss three models. One is a model for predicting pregnancy outcomes. The other is a model for predicting IVF outcomes. And the third is a model for predicting PCOS. And these models in turn, the first one enhances family planning. And as you will see, it actually highlights a number of important factors that are affecting fecundability. In terms of predicting IVF outcomes, one important consideration is that, again, enhances family planning and also financial decision-making that couples have to go through when deciding to seek these types of treatments. And finally, with respect to this polycystic ovary syndrome, there are a significant large number of undiagnosed cases in the US, and predictive models can help enable early intervention and addressing, therefore, the long-term health risks that are associated with this type of condition. So starting with the first model, we use data from a study. It's called the Pregnancy Study Online, PRESTO for short. This is a web-based preconception cohort study of women in the US and Canada, women of reproductive age, actively trying to conceive. It is led by Lauren Wise at Boston University, who is a co-PI in the grant that has been funded this work. So women that are interested in participating in the study, they submit an online questionnaire at enrollment, and then every 2 months for up to 12 months or until they get pregnant. And there is also an opportunity for male partners to participate in the study. So the data set we used had about 4,000 or so participants, and we extracted from the questionnaires 163 variables that covered a variety of different factors, from socio-demographic factors, lifestyle, diet, medical history, and selected male partner characteristics. Earlier work in this space was more in the mold of epidemiological research, looking at one factor at a time. So the contributions here is trying to look at all the factors at the same time and sort of optimize what factors are the most predictive of the final outcome of interest. And in this case, we I'll present two models. One is predicting pregnancy within 6 months. Again, these are women that are trying to conceive and they are not using ART technologies. And the second model is predicting pregnancy with 12 months. So you can see in these tables that the AUC or AR under the curve is some metric of accuracy is on the order of 70-71%, so moderate ability to predict. And it's also interesting, I think, that what we label as a sparse and robust model, it gives you better predictive performance than a full model that uses the entire set of variables that were available to us. And the models that we develop are interpretable, and you can see some of the factors that are the more significant in terms of making the prediction. And in green, we are highlighting some factors that you can argue are potentially modifiable, and they give some ideas on what women could possibly control in order to improve their chances of conceiving. So the paper was published in 2021 in Human Reproduction. And in fact, it was fairly well received by the community. The European Society for Human Reproduction selected this paper for a tutorial, as they call it. So it was discussed for about 24 hours, and that discussion generated about 1,000 tweets and about 1 million impressions. So moving on to the second model. So here we set out to predict whether the first IVF cycle for some participant is going to be successful, is going to lead to a pregnancy. We use data from a number of different IVF clinics that are part of this EIVF platform. So these were clinics from Massachusetts, New York, and California. We had about 22,000 or so cycles, and we had variables including demographics and also variables that had to do with that specific IVF cycle. So the number of oocytes retrieved, number of embryos that were prepared, and lifestyle factors, hormone levels during that cycle, and medical diagnosis associated with the women that were participating in this study. And the outcome was to predict pregnancy after the first IVF cycle. Again, existing models were so far using basic demographics and medical history, and there were no models out there that were using also the in-cycle information, which, as you will see, is fairly important in making a prediction. So performance of these models on the order of 68%, 67% or so, It is interesting that what we call a linear and a robust model does pretty much as well as a very complex, not so interpretable non-linear model. And you can see on the right side of the slide that there are certain predictors, key predictors of the success of the IVF cycle. In green, again, are predictors that you could argue are possibly modifiable. And these are some ideas in terms of what women could do to improve their chances. What is also interesting is that there are some racial variables that ended up being fairly significant. And I think they point to the fact that IVF cycles have been optimized for certain races, and certain other races are sort of disadvantaged because of the way these procedures have been optimized. And this is food for thought. The final model I'll present is trying to assess cases of PCOS that are undiagnosed. So about 30,000 or so women that were included in the data set we had access to. And we selected women that should have an PCOS diagnosis. They were not checked for so-called polycystic ovarian morphology. So therefore, they did not have a diagnosis in their electronic health record, even though they should have based on other factors. Existing models in this space were focusing more on the development of PCOS rather than helping identify the undiagnosed cases, which our models did. So you can see again here the performance of these models. Again, it's interesting that what we call linear, robust model has performance that is very close to a non-linear, very complex, not so interpretable model. Again, you can see the number of different variables that are important in terms of this model. And you can see again some possibly modifiable factors, but also some racial factors that are playing a role. So given that this is NSF, just in the last 2 minutes or so, I would like to just peek behind the curtain and give you some idea about some of the methods that are behind the models that we're developing in general. And our work has been motivated by working in healthcare and developing these sort of models. There are usually a large number of predictive variables. We need to avoid overfitting. We need to optimize out-of-sample performance. Interpretability is quite important. So sparse models are interesting. Linear models are interesting because of this reason. One sort of meta-observation is that with proper feature selection, linear models can do as well as much more complex, non-linear, and not interpretable models. And also there is a need for robustness because of a lot of issues with medical data. In fact, we have developed a framework for what we call distributionally robust learning. And just to give you an idea of what this is, typically when you develop a model, you are trying to optimize, minimize some loss function with respect to usually a probability distribution that generates the data that you do not know, and you are using the probability distribution that can be derived from a training data set in order to assess that expected loss. So in this methodology that we have developed, we are essentially letting that probability distribution that generates the data to be anything it can be. You can argue essentially that nature is doing the worst possible thing for developing the model in selecting a worst case probability distribution. And we as modelers come after this, and we are learning a model that is trying to minimize the worst case expected loss that nature has somehow selected for us. So because of this min-max structure, there is a robustness embedded in the development of this model. And this is part of what is known as distributionally robust optimization approach to learning. What is, I think, interesting, and this also leads to some mathematical facility in dealing with these types of problems. We are using an ambiguity set for selecting these probability distributions that is based on a Wasserstein metric that is centered around the empirical probability distribution that is generated by the training set. So I will conclude by thanking many of my students that have contributed to this work that are listed in this slide, and also thanking my collaborators, Lauren Wise, Sruthi Mahalingaya at Harvard, Lauren Wise at BU, and Alex Olszewski at BU, who are also co-PIs in the grant that supported this work. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Chaitra Gopalappa.
Hey, thank you everyone for joining, and thanks to NSF for this funding and invitation to present. So the title of our talk is, or of our work is, Simulation and Decision Analysis for Integrated Modeling of Diseases, Healthy Lives for All Approach. The motivation, decades of research using observational studies has shown that socioeconomic factors, the y-axis of the bottom graph, are key determinants of health and thus simply called social determinants of health. However, intervention analysis models, the ones on the right, have traditionally focused on behavioral and pharmaceutical interventions, not modeling social determinants, and the silo single disease approach is myopic as it overlooks the root cause of diseases. On the other hand, observational studies help inform structural intervention programs. However, the fragmented approach of different sectors targeting different social determinants may not be effective for disease prevention. Now, many community-based organizations already strive to provide combined care to their community. However, the lack of a systemic approach means both inoptimal use of resources, and as the burden of planning for coordinated care is shifted to the community, there is the risk that more the disadvantaged community, higher the strain on its system, likely compounding disparities. A long-term goal is to develop a decision support tool that helps predict potential health risks specific to a population and joint intervention needs to inform a more systemic change in allocation of public health resources that optimize health and social equity. This could help inform interagency programs and policies at the federal or state agency level. And at the care facility level, it helps infrastructure and operational planning. This is a complex problem and a long-term goal. Our short-term goal is to advance the modeling research needed to achieve this long-term goal. Advancements in AI can play a critical role in addressing this problem. However, pure data-driven AI lacks the robustness. Therefore, our approach is to combine physics-based methods with AI to build mechanistic models, which we can then use in conjunction with AI for scalability. For this grant, we use sexually and intravenously transmitted infections as a case study. Observational studies have shown many social determinants are drivers of risky sexual and injecting drug use behaviors. These behaviors are common modes of transmission for multiple infections, which in turn lead to other severe diseases. There's biological interactions between these diseases. It is thus necessary to intervene on each of these mechanisms to effectively avert infection risk. So our goal is to develop a model that simulates all these mechanisms so that we can predict populations at risk of infection and determine optimal combinations of interventions. There are multiple challenges in developing such a model. I will provide an overview of three of them. The first, complex system dynamics. So we need a suitable method to jointly model diseases of varying epidemiology. Second, complex dependency between features, but we mostly have data on the pairwise associations between a social determinant and a behavior. So we want to estimate the multivariate joint distributions. Third, we need new algorithms to identify optimal combinations of interventions in the context of disease syndemics and epidemic dynamics. I will provide a brief overview of work on the three challenges. There are many collaborators on each of these work. I will only highlight the lead student authors on the papers I cite. Challenge one, the goal is a technique to joint model interacting diseases that may vary epidemiologically but have same behavioral transmission mechanisms. The status quo is we either have compartmental models that are sufficient for fast spreading but not suitable for slower spreading diseases, or network models that are suitable for all but face challenges in application to multi-disease because of the varying epidemiology. Taking an example, if we simulate 100,000 nodes, we have 3,900 cases of HPV, but only 10 cases of HIV. Scaling 10 times is still not sufficient for the slow spreading diseases, but drastically increases computational challenges, which is of concern in this context of multi-diseases. Our approach is thus a mixed model. The red nodes are persons infected with at least one slow spreading disease. The green nodes are their susceptible contacts, and the rest of the population are in the compartmental model. As new infections occur, that is, the green nodes become infected with a slow spreading disease, their contacts move from the compartmental to the network. So this makes it easy to generate large sample sizes in the network. The novelty is a network generation algorithm that maintains the many dynamics, including the network structure, which is not random, age correlation, geographical correlation, partnership changes over time, and so on. To demonstrate the significance of such a model, we applied it to HIV, HPV, and cervical cancer. HPV is 1.7 times higher, and cervical cancer is 3.6 times higher in women with HIV compared to women without, which is already known. What the study adds is the percent attribution to biological versus behavioral factors, and thus the need for structural plus behavioral interventions versus pharmaceutical interventions. An unexpected outcome we realized later was that the new model can also generate cluster outbreaks, which led us to building the first national level model for HIV in the US that accurately replicated cluster outbreaks. And I state this here because model validity is extremely important if you want to use it for informing policy decisions. Well, up until this work, we had validated it on many demographic-based surveillance metrics. This application allowed us to more intricately validate the network structure and features from the micro to the macro scales, which really increased the confidence in the model. Apart from validity, the application is also significant and novel. Cluster detection and response are conducted using DNA sequence of the virus from recent diagnosis, which means it can detect recent outbreaks. So this helps us move from cluster detection and response to cluster prediction and prevention. Challenge two is estimation of the joint distributions. The overall goal is to use data, which are mainly pairwise associations or marginal distributions, to estimate the joint distributions that we then use to parameterize the simulation model. So in the simulation, in addition to simulating the various behavioral risk elements, we jointly add SDH features. We still simulate infection risk as a function of behaviors, but as social determinants are jointly modeled, just wanted to see some questions. Okay, but as social determinants are jointly modeled with behaviors, we can evaluate joint intervention needs. For here, I will only focus on the joint distribution estimation. So very briefly, the novelty here was developing a method to integrate the disparate data sets. Mainly, we have multiple large national data sets, but located in different data sets conducted by different agencies. So integrating that by applying continuous copula to learn the dependency and transforming it to discrete copula to extract the bivariate joints, which were then combined in graphical models to estimate the multivariate. So this is the slide that was discussing about the method. So really using the continuous to discrete copulas to extract the bivariate associations and then incorporating all of the bivariate associations into graphical models to estimate the multivariate joints. To demonstrate the significance of such a model, we conducted hypothetical analysis, and these are the sample results. The two graphs show SDH burden in people with HIV on the left and women who exchange sex on the right. On the y-axis is the distribution as percent of people, and the x-axis is the number of disadvantaged SDH. So these graphs tell us what percent of people have zero SDH, one SDH, and so on. We also know what those different combinations are, which can shed light on intervention needs. We can also do threshold impact analysis to estimate maximum impact from structural interventions. For example, here we did, what if an intervention improved HIV care behavior in people with greater than zero SDH to become equal to behavior in people with zero SDH? What is its impact on not only HIV, but HPV and cervical cancer? So what is the significance of these joint distributions and hypothetical analysis? As the number of combination interventions increases, even designing or testing interventions through controlled trials becomes a challenge. So this type of data analysis can help identify or streamline viable joint interventions that we can then be used to testing, that can then be used in controlled trials, which in turn provides the evidence for the model for analysis of interventions. The last one is AI for control optimization. The goal is identifying intervention combinations, but there are multiple scales of complexity. First, for each disease, we have multiple levels of interventions, structural, behavioral, and pharmaceutical, specific to demographics. Second, we have multiple diseases. And third, we want policies specific to each jurisdiction, but while considering the fact that epidemics are not restricted to geographical boundaries, that is, there is mixing across the jurisdictions. We use deep reinforcement learning algorithms, first a single agent for a single disease and then a multi-agent for multi-jurisdiction. The novelty here was mainly efficient formulations to improve convergence, which is of concern when we are talking about a very complex problem. But this work also helped us test different algorithms and identify research gaps. And the main challenge was that as the number of agents increases, the algorithms become more challenging to converge. So as part of ongoing work, we are developing new algorithms on this specific grant. Very briefly, we are mainly trying to leverage the system's knowledge for coordinating learning of the policy or the value networks of the reinforcement learning, but each agent is able to execute its own policies. So I will just conclude by summarizing that our work developed novel methods in multi-scale simulation, statistical machine learning, and multi-agent reinforcement learning. I would like to acknowledge the many collaborators on this grant from the various organizations, and that's the QR code for the publications. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chaitra. Our final speaker is Professor Ramesh Johari from the Department of Management Science and Engineering at Stanford University.
Great. Thank you, Georgianne. Thank you to the National Science Foundation for hosting us today, and also, of course, for the funding that supported this type of work. So I'm going to be talking to you today about a project that is in collaboration with Stanford Children's Health. I actually deliberately set my background to be the Stanford Children's Health background, even though I'm in the engineering school at Stanford. And in part, that's really to highlight the fact, I think, that kind of a major point I'm going to try to make today is that it's essential to start in partnership with clinicians and care providers when you're trying to actually impact care on the ground. So with that in mind, let's jump in. First, diabetes. I think all of us know that diabetes is prevalent with an incredibly large disease burden, but just to put some numbers on it, there's 38 million individuals that are at least diagnosed with some form of diabetes. There's 98 million adults that have prediabetes. I actually am among them. And specific to this talk, I'm going to be focusing on some care changes in care model for type 1 diabetes. And there's 300,000 youth, under 18 years old, diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. You know, unsurprisingly, just like you've heard in the other talks, disparities abound by race, by socioeconomic status, by education. And so, you know, any care model that you change needs to also be accounting for that. Okay, so let me start with sort of a slide that's actually the end of the talk at some level, which is, you know, what is amazing about this project that I'm a part of at Stanford. It's an incredibly large team, and I'll have a slide at the end that shows you the team that's had amazing effect on caring for type 1 diabetes. So what you're seeing here is 12-month outcomes in newly diagnosed youth. So the recent paper that came out in Nature Medicine just in April of this year. And in this work, what we're reporting on are 12-month outcomes under a new care model from the study, the 4T study. The 4T stands for teamwork, targets, technology, and tight control. And you know what I really want to highlight in this picture is that if you look at the historical cohort that we're comparing against the historical control cohort, the HbA1cs in that cohort were about 7.6, 7.7% 12 months after diagnosis. Whereas in the 4T study group, in study one in particular, that dropped to 6.5%. And one of the things I want to point out here, without getting into the details of how to interpret A1C, what I really like is one of my collaborators, the PI on the NIH grant that funded this, David Maz, is fond of saying that if the 4T study intervention was a pill, it would be worth billions of dollars, because that's the type of thing that is extremely difficult to accomplish in diabetes care. So I think of that kind of as the end story here. You know, this is the type of improvement that's been happening. What is the talk about? The talk is really about thinking about, well, what is the role of technology? And so, you know, here's where I want to really talk in, as an engineer. What is it that technology brings to the table in achieving these kinds of outcomes? I'd say that, you know, the way I think about those outcomes are those are on par with the best that you could get if you had intensive human management of these conditions. So again, you know, I really want to emphasize here that the grounding has to be that you start with the clinical context. You start with patients, providers, devices, data. What are the interventions available to you? From there, you start asking yourself, you know, what are feasible and efficient innovations that could be implemented? And fundamentally in our work, it's thinking about what kinds of algorithm augmented improvements in care could we create? And then what you do is you get this virtuous cycle going where you can go back and you can say, okay, from what we've implemented, what have we learned? What worked? What didn't work? That actually changes the clinical context, that changes the data, that changes how you think about interventions. And in turn, that should be changing your thoughts on what feasible and efficient innovations in the next stage could look like. So this is my viewpoint on how we do effective engineering within the clinical context. And you can see, I hope, that you know the partnership here is kind of a key piece of that, right? In this talk, I'm going to sort of talk a little bit about an instantiation of this viewpoint specifically for improving care for children with type 1 diabetes. So the status quo in care for type 1 diabetes is a number of different ways of measuring your glucose levels over time. the best you could hope for is what's called a continuous glucose monitor that continuously measures your glucose levels. But even with these monitors, historically, data was really only reviewed every 3 months, which might mean you would have these sort of moments in between the three-month visits where control is deteriorating and it's completely missed until the next three-month visit. So obviously, what you'd love to be able to do is to say, hey, why can't I review this data more frequently? Why isn't there a way to actually intervene with patients more frequently, in which case you could potentially detect and address that deteriorating control sooner? So in 2020, working closely with the clinical care providers, and by closely, I really mean specifically talking to them about what kind of tool would be useful, there's the launch of the first version of what we call TIDE, Timely Interventions for Diabetes Excellence. Now, here's really what I want to point out to you, and I think you got a hint of this even in Yanis's talk, that you know, we're fond of using the most advanced technology, but the truth here was that in talking to the care providers, the most important thing was not to build the world's fanciest algorithm. It was actually to just build something that works and that they could use and engage with and provide feedback on. So this first dashboard was deployed in less than a month using R Shiny, which is one of the easiest open source packages to use, just on a single laptop, not even on the cloud. And you know, this is what it looked like. It contained a number of different diagnostic criteria, notably things like the time within target glucose range. By 2021, we had been able to use continuous improvement, iterative improvement, and buy-in from providers to scale up to a new version of TIDE that looks a lot more like the types of platforms that you would expect for digital health, where it's deployed on a server now so that all providers can access it without needing their own laptop, contextual ranking, and risk stratification of patients into different groups. What that meant was that we had taken a pain point for the providers, being able to provide this continuous kind of view to patients without being overburdened, worked closely with them to iterate, deployed something that not only was delivering better care, as you saw in the initial chart on A1C, but actually was delivering more efficient care. And what you could see here is that we had two, you know, this is depicting sort of improvements in the time of review with a couple of successive iterative improvements that we made to the platform, changing the flagging and ranking criteria and changing our deployment to be using Tableau. And you can see that that led to a 36% and then a 37% reduction in the time spent per patient review. And so, you know, these kinds of improvements, I think for me, what was striking as an engineer is I historically would have put the cart before the horse to build the thing and then hope that somebody uses it. And what's amazing to me was that starting with the absolute simplest thing, something that arguably you wouldn't even consider necessarily as a technological innovation, given the tools available to us, was so important from a human standpoint to get buy-in from the clinical team. But here's the thing. So that gets us from left to right. That gets us from the context to something deployed. What's great is that once you're deployed, once you have buy-in, once you have a tool that's being used, that tool is generating its own data. And that data allows us to learn and allows us to think about the next step. So in going back from here to here and thinking about how the context has changed, we can think about what the next stage of the evolution of these kinds of tools can look like. So the next part of this talk, I want to talk to you very quickly about a couple of lessons of what we can learn from TIDE. Now, fundamentally, I think, you know, if you think about what's challenging about healthcare, and especially this kind of digital health intervention, I'd say one of the biggest reasons that interventions that claim that they can improve patient care fail or fail to be adopted is because providers are on the front line of caring for patients. And fundamentally, there's a very limited number of providers and many, many patients. And even if you believe that digital health interventions can automate some part of that process, the gating factor will always be the ability of providers to be intermediaries to that care. So when you're optimizing care under capacity constraints, the question you're really asking is, how do I maximize and efficiently target the resources that these providers are giving to the system? So the first thing that we were thinking about here is something along the lines of learning personalized treatment policies. And sort of a simple way to think about that is, given patient state, which patient should you prioritize for review or contact? So when I showed you that dashboard earlier, each row is a patient with their statistics. And kind of one of the questions we're asking ourselves is, well, who should be higher or lower within the different risk strata? And that's important because it's affecting the sort of attention of the providers and who they think needs most care that week. Now, a key challenge here is that the patient's state every week is actually extremely high dimensional. It's a weekly time series of 5-minute intervals of continuous glucose monitor data, potentially also activity monitor data, et cetera. And so learning those representations is actually quite challenging. And you know, as a computer scientist, as an engineer, we would think to ourselves, well, why don't we just use black box methods to learn representations of what the state of the patient is and what treatment intervention would make the most sense for them? And what you see if you use black box representations is you get some very weird behavior in the prioritization of patients. For example, just to take a look at something like time in range. So time in range is measuring what's the fraction of time in the past week you were within a target range. The higher that number is, the better you're doing. And arguably, a patient who's higher on time in range, clinical guidelines say, you know, that's probably not a patient who needs intervention this week. Conversely, if your time in range is low, this is probably a patient that providers want to reach out to intervene on, to at least have a conversation with about, you know, what might be leading to that low time in range. And you can see that the black box representations, you know, they're actually at best sort of flat, and at worst actually learning the wrong kind of relationship here. You can see some similar effects in some of these other metrics that I won't go through in detail. By contrast, one of the things that we spend time on is actually taking advantage of inductive bias in the process of learning representations using sort of clinician-informed guidance. And what that led to then is that the prioritization that you get out aligns with clinical guidelines and actually performs better as well. There's a reason the clinical guidelines look the way they do. And so in particular, what you see is that when patients have higher time in range, they're less likely to be prioritized when we use these clinician-informed representations. I also want to mention that where we're headed with this is that we want to be able to, on an ongoing basis, inject randomization into the system so that we can optimize the performance of the prioritization policies that we use and the capacity allocation policies that we use. And I think one thing I want to point out to you is that when you have these kinds of platforms available and running, then the implicit and explicit randomization that's present in these kinds of platforms can actually enable prospective simulations of trials so that you can actually maximize the targeting efficacy, the policy design. So just as a simple example of this, in a recent paper, we talked about estimation of the predictive probability of success of an optimization trial, depending on which targeting policy you would choose to test in the next trial. And I think one of the things I want to point out here is this is saying, you know, how many patients do you need to reach a particular predicted probability of success on your trial? And if you use random targeting, you know, you may need, you know, somewhere between 100 to 150 patients if you're running a 1-week trial to reach a reasonable level of predictive probability of success. And that can cut down significantly if you use a better targeting policy, like one which, for example, targets patients with the largest expected effect. There's a problem here, of course. You want to be careful because targeting should not be at the expense of equitable care. And that's kind of an important aspect of our current policy and trial design. In the future, we're working towards scaling the model with a nonprofit Tide pool, which has deployed actually a version of Tide that we're now piloting in the Stanford Clinic, and it's turnkey available to 12,000 clinics nationwide. Enables all sorts of additional features and data logging. And one of the great things here is the Tide pool is something that, you know, is that next iterative step. And so I kind of want to wrap up here by just noting that what we've been able to see with Tide and with 4T is that continuous improvement is really essential to really achieving the impact of digital health intervention. And I think a big part of that I want to emphasize from this talk is starting at the care team and the patients. The failure modes for these kinds of things happen because we inject ourselves at the algorithms first. And our main learning is really that if you start here and you get in and get something that's working, then the flywheel can get started much more effectively. So with that, I've got a partial list of references here that will be in the slides and a very, very large team. I also want to thank the NIH, Stanford Maternal and Child Health Research Institute, Human-Centered AI Institute, Helmsley Trust, and of course, the National Science Foundation for all the support. So thank you.
Thank you all. These are excellent, excellent talks. So we have a little bit of time for Q&A. I'd like to address the first question first to Chaitra. And the question is, how do you go about validating the models using surveillance data to get a distribution of disease dynamics?
Sure. In this case, you know, I'll give you an example for HIV. So we have HIV, national HIV surveillance systems, which looks at how many people were diagnosed every year by different risk groups. We can also have incidence estimations from different methods. So how many new people were infected in a year by demographics. And third, we can also look at the stage of diagnosis. So in the model, we are tracking the disease stage. So we can look at how long has it been since the persons were infected. Yeah, so there are many demographic factors for incidence, prevalence, and stage of diagnosis that we looked at the macro scale. And at the network level, we mainly used cluster, molecular cluster-based data. What that is so people who are diagnosed with HIV, the DNA sequence of the viruses can be used to look at how closely the viruses are connected in transmissions. So that gives us some insight on the transmission networks. And we were able to use that to compare our model against for validation. And this is done every year. So we have ongoing data that we can use for validating.
Wonderful. Thank you. Yanis, do you have anything to add to that?
Not really. I think it's important to actually take some of these models and validate them on larger populations and, you know, multiple sites, because typically there may be differences in the way some of these data sets are constructed, specifically if the data set is coming from a single site. So that's always an important consideration in developing these models. I think another important consideration, which is now very standard practice, is when one is looking at performance of these models, clearly performance metrics would be evaluated out of sample, so in a part of the data that have not been used in order to develop or train the model, so to test the generalizability of the model beyond the training data.
Thank you very much. Ramesh, any comments on the model validation?
Yeah, I think, I don't have a lot to add to what the other two said. I think one thing I will say is that it's part of the reason that we're so excited about micro-randomization, about injecting a little bit of randomization. I think Chaitra pointed out sort of having controlled and observational studies alongside each other. And I think having a little bit of randomization in the data that you're getting back is a great way to be able to get that kind of model validation on an ongoing basis in these continuous systems.
Thank you very much. I'd like to address this next question first to Yanis. Can your research on disparities such as racial disparities in IVF treatment impact how the biomedical community deals with other instances of health disparities rather than just on IVF?
Yes, thank you for this question. So I think there are two types of disparities that one can talk about. One is what perhaps we can call algorithmic disparity, in the sense that an algorithm is trying to exploit disparities that are present in the data, and perhaps by doing so, accentuating that disparity or developing models that are not equitable. So there is ongoing work on that space, and we have done some related work on how essentially to correct models for these types of disparities and produce models that are more equitable across different cohorts of patients. Now, there is the larger question, how do you deal with disparities that may be present in the data? And for instance, in my presentation, I talked about some disparities that are present in terms of IVF outcomes. So this is a disparity that is fairly well recognized. So there are other studies that point to different success rates for different cohorts based on race, based on other factors. And My collaborator, Ruthie Mahalingai at Harvard, who is an OBGYN physician, I'm not, has two hypotheses. One is that there is potentially differences in terms of education and information that is available. And there may be also potentially issues with the way these IVF protocols have been optimized, so to speak. So I think the first is being addressed in the sense that there are foundations out there, there are practices out there that are trying to improve education and information available to different types of cohorts. I'm not aware of any efforts to modify IVF protocols so that you make them more specific for specific cohorts.
Thank you. Ramesh, similar question on equity and how it relates to your work specifically and in general about the biomedical implications of equity considerations.
Yeah, I think I wanted to say two things on that question. One is about access. And so there's a policy question here about ensuring access, even just to the basic technological infrastructure that enables a patient to participate in remote monitoring. One of the great ironies is that I think the patients who stand to benefit most are exactly those who live in regions where access to specialty care is extremely difficult. On the other hand, those are also often the geographic regions where technological barriers are the highest. So I think that's one major issue I want to highlight. And there are some aspects of this project that have tried to tackle that from a policy perspective, but admittedly that remains a huge and challenging national problem. I think the other one I want to highlight though on the intervention side is that I do think it's critical when one is thinking about personalized interventions, the way you deal with providing equity and equitable care is that you ensure that if your targeting policy is favoring some patients over others, that there are other interventions that are appropriate for the patients who are, let's say, less prioritized according to that role. In our clinic, for example, that means certain patients may be less responsive to messaging, in which case the providers will often be reaching out to those particular patients with phone calls instead. So having multimodal care allows you actually to target the intervention better to the individual. I think sometimes we mistake personalized interventions for elimination of access for certain patients. And I think that would be a disaster. So that's again where starting with the clinical context is fundamental.
Thank you. Chaitra, equability concerns are very central to your work. What are your thoughts on that question?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in our work, you know, like what I showed, we do see that a lot of risky behavior is correlated with social determinants. And in this one, we only looked at the joint distributions, but not necessarily the causality, you know, like what are the causes. We do see that disparities by certain demographics are much higher than other populations. So, and what is the reason? You know, is it socioeconomic factors or is it discrimination or is it just lack of research in the understanding for the specific risk associated to a certain population? And I think, you know, sort of, I think as the other two panelists mentioned, you know, it is really collectively thinking about all of these features and to, you know, understanding or estimating the causality is a very complex challenge. And even conducting such control studies may not be feasible, but how can we use these large data sets to observe longitudinal changes? You know, there are several programs that have been implemented over time to address the several social determinants, so the structural intervention programs. So can we use that data, even if it is just cross-sectional data, just seeing the longitudinal changes of the programs to sort of try and infer what the causal factors are, both from the perspective of what interventions are working, but also to understand the causality between these different features.
Thank you. We have a number of pressing questions, but I think unfortunately we're out of time. So I really, really want to thank the excellent speakers that we have. And thank you to all the participants for attending the webinar.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.